period was also a moment where it became increasingly clear to more and more people that fair and just immigration policies were far more of a pipe dream than no borders. That if we're going to dream, we should dream big and not dream in the images that the state puts in our mind. So we really, at that time, rejected the idea that there's anything just or fair about migration controls. So we really wanted to put that out there.
Well, I mean, borders themselves are a dream, right? Yeah. The idea that you can keep people out of a territory is a complete fantasy. So how come my vision is utopian and your vision to keep everyone out and control everyone who comes across is somehow a kind of realistic possibility?
People did tend to see it, no borders, as either some kind of bad policy proposal they wanted to debate or as a classic example of, you know, some kind of 19th century utopian proposal that you can kind of just blow off. So in between those, we were trying to insist on its practical political character and the need to reinvent politics along the way.
Welcome everyone to an English episode of The Verbranders, a podcast on Europe's borders and resistance against them. I am Wiebe Ruitenberg.
And I'm Neske Barwald.
The Verbranders is Dutch for harga, an Arabic word used in Morocco, Tunisia and Algeria. Harga literally means those who burn, and it is used to speak of people who cross European borders without permission. It refers to the burning of identity papers. Those who do harga seek life, and in doing so burn Europe's borders. Our guests today are Bridget Anderson, Cynthia Wright and Nandita Sharma. We speak to them about their editorial called Why No Borders, which was published in 28. In it, they draw the logical conclusion of scholarships on borders at the time, namely that we should get rid of borders. Taking this editorial as our starting point, we speak about collaboration and the joy of working together with people who we connect with politically and who we have fun with. And we talk about No Borders as a practical political project, carried out in the here and now by all the different people who refuse to conform to nationalized borders. We recorded this episode right after Maritime Solidarities Conference that brought Bridget, Cynthia and Nandita to Amsterdam in September of 2023. This was weeks before the Israeli state took the Hamas attack on the 7th of October as an opportunity to escalate the destruction of Palestinian life in Gaza and the West Bank. We don't speak about Palestine in this episode, but as we published this in January 2024, we want to state that the freedom dreams we express in this episode apply to Palestine in particular. And right now, we must act. We must reject this total destruction of life. We must resist the occupation. We must resist settler colonialism. We must resist ethnic nationalist states. And we must refuse to lose, as Bridget puts it in this episode. Enjoy listening.
So welcome, Nandita, Bridget, Cynthia.
Thank you.
Such an honor to have you here in Amsterdam with us in our studio. We are here to talk about your piece that you wrote in 2008 called Why No Borders. But we're also here to talk about kind of friendship, collaboration, struggles against borders, where we are now, where we were then, where we're going. So absolute honor to have you here with us.
Great to be here.
Thank you so much.
So to start out, I already mentioned the word friendship. It struck us when meeting you that you have such a warm kind of intimate relationship with each other. And we thought maybe that would be a nice place to start for the conversation today. So could you please kind of talk a little bit about yourself and also how you met, how you started collaborating and how that collaboration evolved?
Well, thank you, Neske, for that question, because it's a really wonderful place to begin. Just at its most simple place to begin, I think one is to start with how we met, which was, I think, in 2000, no? We were at a feminist conference in Toronto that I think was sponsored by the institution that I was then working in on a contract basis. That was the University of Toronto. I was finishing what turned out to be a insecure 5-year contract. And Nandita had come to that conference, I think, already with an Open the Borders manifesto and emerging out of some of the work that had been going on in the West Coast, right? So we can talk more about that moment, but I think the three of us all met in that same place. We didn't know each other personally before that, and we started collaborating almost right away. So it wasn't one of those situations where you're already friends and then you say, let's do this particular project together based on the knowledge and trust that you have of each other. We started improvising from the beginning. And one place where that began, and it might be something we can also talk about, is Nandita then organized a conference on the West Coast. And we also, almost from the beginning, started talking about doing a book together. But it ended up being, in fact, that special issue in which that editorial, Why No Borders, appears. So that's my first point of departure about how we met and began to collaborate.
Yeah, yeah. I remember meeting, this is Nandita, I remember meeting Cynthia by handing her a flyer saying, please come to this, at that time we were calling it Open the Borders.
Yeah.
Mm. Please come to this Open the Borders conference that I'm organizing in Vancouver, because I had already known Cynthia's name because she had been active in anti-racist movements in Toronto. And I met Bridget a few hours later, also by handing her a flyer, because she was giving a paper at this same conference on her new book at that time, on migrant domestic workers in different states in Europe. And I was instantly, we were like, okay, we're going to this conference. They're coming. This is so exciting. And then it went from there.
Yeah, we never looked back.
Yeah, even though I think in the case of my friendship with Bridget, I think we've only really met a handful of times actually in person.
Oh, really?
And got to know each other maybe the most in that sense, maybe, you know, when I stayed with you for a few days last year, we got to know each other in a deeper way. But a lot of this has happened over email. I mean, I've been able to see Nandita more in person. So, yeah, it's developed and deepened in all sorts of collaborative ways and in a friendship way.
I've slept on the couch of both of these women various times over the years.
Yeah, because Nandita has done the most circuit among the three of us. Yeah.
But I do think also that... it's Bridget speaking. Yeah. I do think that sometimes I think we don't have enough words in English anyway for friendship.
You know, because comradeship.
Because there's just different kinds of friendship, right? And for me, I think the most kind of exciting relationship is the relationship where you really care for people, you love them, you think they're really funny, you know, you enjoy talking to them, but also that you share a common political project.
Yes.
And that's incredibly energizing.
Yeah.
And in some ways, I kind of feel for people that don't have that experience of kind of comradeship plus. I don't know how to call it. But it's also, I think, enables you, gives you energy, and it enables you to be more creative, I think, and keeps you going. Because it's actually, you know, it's hard work. You know, it's whatever people say, it's hard work editing volumes and, like, absolutely. I don't know, putting stuff together, putting conferences together. And I think, having those sorts of particular kind of friendship is really important.
Yeah, in my case, because, you know, starting in 2000, 2001, I began a very long period of academic precarity, just teaching course by course for a very long time before I got a position. So being able to do collaborative work of this nature was very important to me, very energizing in between running around chasing a dollar and a contract. But also the dynamism of how much you learn when you work in collaboration, you know, across very different kinds of settings with very different experience. But I think we recognized in each other almost from the beginning that, you know, we were working from a somewhat similar kind of political trajectory and asking similar kinds of questions, right? We perceived that in each other. So, you know, because it was interesting starting to collaborate with people that you didn't necessarily have a long prior organizing history with in the same space, right?
Well, I think it really makes a difference. Like, I think our friendship and collaborations, academic collaborations, come out of the fact that all three of us were activists long before we were academics. And I think that makes such a difference in terms of our priorities, our research priorities, in terms of having them align with building social movements.
Mm. Yeah.
So I think that it's also very rare in either activism or academia to have activist scholars.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we really connected at that level as well.
Mm-hmm.
Though I have to say, I think it's less rare now, especially around migration and no borders. I think, you know, more than 20 years, that's how long we've known each other. Scary. Mm-hmm. I think it was rare. Whereas now I think there's a whole lot more people who are activist scholars.
True.
And what did each of you kind of bring to your collaboration?
That's a difficult question.
Maybe one starting point is that I can talk about what I learned from Bridget and from Nandita, right? One piece that I learned from them, because their academic and also organizing work was very deeply located in questions at the intersection of labor, citizenship, race, and nation, especially around trying to understand, like in Nandita's work, in the Canadian case, the dynamics of the so-called temporary foreign, I'm using, as you can see in the studio, but maybe not to listeners, every air quotes around both temporary and around foreign, all of these kinds of things that Nandita unpacks in her first book and in the organizing work. That was one important thing that both of them were bringing to the table for me, because neither my academic nor organizing work was in that particular set of areas. Like, one of the things I started thinking more about was people who are wholly undocumented or people with various forms of precarious or conditional status, right? But what they were bringing to the table is a deeper understanding for me of how that works within the context of global labor, global capitalism. All these things were important because, you know, one of the things that formed my activism, I think it's the same for you, Nadine, on the West Coast, was that particular kind of epoch, especially in the 70s and into the 80s, when a lot of work was done under the rubric of immigrant worker struggles, right? That is the strikes, the important strikes led by immigrant workers and so on. And the framework was often around the category of immigrant worker, right? Which was super important for linking the question of labor with race and capitalism on a global scale. It had its limits as a framework, but it offered that set of questions, right? I think different sets of questions are now on the table than maybe were being asked in the 70s and into the 80s, but that was a big part of the formation, right? And so that's a piece of what they were bringing to the table that I learned from them, as well as how to think beyond the problem of what the problems are into what are the standpoints for organizing beyond asking for a fair deal for the worker, right? Or a free and fair immigration system. What might that horizon look like when you set up the question differently?
I think, so putting the question like that, I mean, for me, what I really learned from the two of you is this whole engagement with the questions around indigeneity, which I think loom very large from the North American context, and which in Europe, you know, even the term indigenous sort of sends shivers down my spine, you know, indigenous rights. And I think about, you know, the National Front and kind of the far right. And I think that I would have found it really hard to get a grip on the questions around indigeneity in the North American, the Australian context. But I've found that kind of like reading your work and talking to you and seeing how you kind of manage that is actually incredibly useful.
And I think that one of the things that all three of us perhaps are motivated by is irritation of popular discourses around migration, for example. Like one of the things that we've all connected on is our serious problems with the anti-trafficking discourse. Right? So it seemed to me that, you know, after we met in 2000, there was just a series of conversations that just kept going, right, around the problems with anti-trafficking, the problems with indigenous nationalisms. And I actually do think that over time, the three of us have pushed each other up in our ability to critically think of these discourses and political frameworks and how they're hindering the development of social movements and, you know, revolutionary change.
And I think that's something that actually activist scholars, this is an important role that we can do, right? Because states are endlessly coming up with what looks like potentially kind of attractive frameworks for how to deal with the so-called problem of migration or problems of, I don't know, competition or addiction. And sometimes I can really understand how if you're sort of like up against it and, you know, on the front line of struggles and struggling yourself, it's sort of like can seem to be sort of solutions. So anti-trafficking, I think, was seen as like, oh, now this is a way that people can get status, you know. So I think that actually being in the privileged situation of having that kind of like resources to reflect not only in time, but also, as you say, Nandita, in a context where you feel like you can engage with each other and kind of push each other and say, oh, I don't know about that, but in a comradely way, I think it is a valuable contribution.
Yeah, I really like your comrade plus expression. And for me, the plus in the way you talk about it is really all these emotions, like both the joy, but also the irritation. And I recognize a lot from what you're saying from how we work. But I wanted to give you a compliment, which is that sometimes these things can become quite closed, right, when you have these dynamics. But seeing you interact with us, but also in the conference in the past few days that we were at the Maritime Solidarities Conference, that's not how it works for you all. Like, it's an energy that people want to latch on to, and it's you're also inviting and welcoming with the energy. But maybe to segue slowly to the piece, the Why No Borders piece. Yeah, maybe we can share a little bit of how we were reading it. So I only read this, I will admit, I think for the first time, maybe 2-3 years ago, when we had already started working on this podcast. And although I was working on migration, I wasn't necessarily thinking about borders so much, which is a strange conjuncture of where migration studies maybe was at that point. And I read the piece and it was quite difficult for me, you know, because it's a piece where a lot of things come together. And I can also sense from the way you're talking about it how each of you brings something and then what comes out is quite a lot, right? And then we read it again for this episode and it wasn't hard for me anymore, you know? It all made so much sense. I was texting Neska about it. I was so impressed when I was reading it with how succinct and clear, but also indeed how comprehensive the piece is, because it's not a very long piece, right? It's, what is it, 10, 12 pages, I think. And there's just so much in it. And I thought, wow, like 15 years ago, they wrote this, you know? And it's so urgent also still. That's how I read it. But maybe you want to add to it.
Well, first of all, I second the appreciation of rereading it and really appreciating how much is in there and written in a clear way. So what I thought, I think, when I've read it the first time and what I thought when I reread it in the last few weeks was, so it condenses a lot of literature and a lot of struggle. And for the listeners, to give you an example, it kind of really clearly states how borders are productive of things like the idea of the good wife and the good child or parent relationship. So how borders kind of produce all of these relationships that they are then said to just react to. And that is, of course, something that you didn't come up with. That was a reflection of long years of struggle, scholarship, and movement of people themselves. But what I thought was very clarifying about the piece was how you eloquently and calmly linked it to No Borders. And I felt like at that time, especially in the academic literature, basically all the, for me at least, I mean, it's an interpretation of it, but all the arrows were pointing in that direction, but the conclusion wasn't made. So actually, there was a lot of work that described the dynamics that you also described in this No Border editorial. It just didn't go to let's work together to shrink this system, shrink, abolish. We need to get rid of this system because it's crushing and killing people and it's producing all of these relationships we don't want. And I think it was a great move to mobilize also the academic capital that you have to calmly, on the basis of evidence, state we should get rid of borders. So I thought, wow, there's a clarity and braveness to it, even though I'm also a bit reluctant to call academics brave, because I think like we're really not on the forefront of these struggles. So, but there is still also a braveness in it that I really appreciate. So, yeah, those are my thoughts. But let us move to listen to a song, because we invited you to bring two pieces of music for us to kind of get in the mood of the mood that you were in writing this piece. And so one song that you selected, I think Cynthia will introduce it for us.
Okay, I'll try to say a few words. Well, first of all, thank you for inviting us to think about music in relation to this podcast, because it immediately revealed a massive gap in my own knowledge, which is the whole question of what does No Borders sound like? What does our movement sound like, right? And at the risk of embarrassing myself in front of A, musicologists, and B, all the beautiful DJs of our movement, I'll just say that, yeah, I found this piece of music. When I heard it, I thought, this is close to what I want to hear. But it did raise that question for me, but also the question of how does language operate in our movements, especially in the space of the Mediterranean, but also globally, both the language of music and also language among people. I like the lyrics of this, but I want to open that question. It might be a good subject for another podcast. Mm-hmm. What does this movement sound like among the many cultural producers and musicians that this movement is producing, right? A very high level of sophistication and interest. So it's a little bit about how I came to it.
Let us listen.
Dancing at the border, singing for new water, Frontex in the corner, we are taking over. When deportation kills and passports murder, freedom of movements, everybody's right. When deportation kills and passports murder, freedom of movements, everybody's right. Illegal, illegal, no one here is illegal. Illegal, illegal, no one here is illegal.
Nie róbcie żadnych mury, bra panu kakasim. Nie walicie na krat, de nie wamilarny swim. Nie dorcie w porty strągą, do szaty jedy budzim. Baszki wasz dłoń do rób, baż do diabli marim. Начали зодин мозе кърко Я бегу дзин да ма стане Върто я туа луфто Европа мили се аз Чита студе кофин Тети и я би краха Те парча в отвърва ми
Илегал, илегал No one here is illegal Илегал, илегал No one here is illegal
Yeah. So could you talk about, I guess, this moment in which you wrote this piece and bring us to that moment? We know there was a moment where the sans-papier movement was very prominent. Mm. So maybe talk a little bit about 2008.
Well, I suppose maybe the first thing to say was, I think at that period, there was this curious disjuncture between, as you say, you have the sans-papier movement, you have actually activism around No Borders,
yeah.
But actually in academia was kind of completely silent about it.
Yeah.
And so, whereas I think today, you know, even if it's not a respectable position, it is at least a position. Whereas I think then it was surprisingly not a position. So I think that was part of what we were responding to. I mean, I found when I look back on it, it was quite funny because I can see like, oh yeah, I remember Cynthia did that bit. Landita in that bit. Yeah, I remember, you know, so it's funny kind of, yeah. I suppose my experience of reading it is seeing the jigsaw that we put together. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, but then I also have a very personal memory of it because it was one of my kids' 18th birthday party. And we were really under pressure to get the wretched thing done because we kind of left it a bit late. And so she was like upstairs with all these kind of like boom, boom. And I was like downstairs in the basement.
Speaking of music and our movements.
Yeah.
I can really relate to this.
I remember that time being a time of great disappointment. So, for example, in the time that we met in 2000, there was a great period of optimism, particularly in the North American context. There were massive movements building of people openly declaring themselves as undocumented and unafraid and, you know, marching on the streets for quite radical demands at that time. Seemed quite radical demands. And then 9/11 happened. And, you know, the hammer of the security state came down really heavy on especially those movements, since terrorism was defined as a foreign threat. And anything to do with foreigners, including supporting people who had been classified as foreigners, became a national security concern. It became more difficult to organize. So I remember when we first met, there was this optimism, and then very shortly thereafter, a huge deflation of our movements. And so we also wrote it, I think, with the urgency of reviving the optimism that we had initially felt when we met. So it seemed to me that that was that political moment. And that period was also a moment where it became increasingly clear to more and more people that fair and just immigration policies were far more of a pipe dream than no borders, right? That if we're going to dream, we should dream big and not dream in the images that the state puts in our minds. So we really, at that time, rejected the idea that there's anything just or fair about migration controls. So we really wanted to put that out there.
Yeah, and justifiably so, right? Because all scholarship shows how when a new category is produced, it creates new relationships of power and new exclusion. So exactly as you say, if you're going to dream, there you can debate about the dreaming, but if you're going to dream, dream big or define your own parameters.
Well, I mean, borders themselves are a dream, right? Yeah. I mean, it's like, well, the idea that you can keep people out of a territory is a complete fantasy.
In a deeply connected world.
Yes, absolutely. So how come my vision is utopian and your vision to keep everyone out and control everyone who comes across is somehow a kind of realistic possibility?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there were a lot of things going on in that moment that I think have been very well described by Bridget and Nandita, and I'll just add maybe a couple of things. First, on the academic context, because I agree that at least certainly in the Canadian context, to take one nationalized example, there had been, to my knowledge, no prior conversation in the academic context about a no borders framework or anything like it, even though there had been, you know, at least a couple of decades of really pathbreaking anti-racist feminist scholarship, precisely, you know, looking at the immigration and refugee system, at labor, at citizenship, taking apart immigration and settlement as category, the whole thing. But there was no kind of no standpoint for thinking through, well, what would a radical alternative look to that? So there was, you know, real need to think through alternatives, but I had this sensation of kind of risking a somersault in the air, like a sense of like, what was the revolutionary tradition we would be building on in advocating this exactly? There's some threads of it in the piece, right, of some prior histories, but it really felt like trying to remap this with your eyes closed, right? So the Sampapye thing, I think, was an important influence, as well as that generation of intellectuals like Etienne Balibar and others who were closely engaged with the movements of the Sampapye going back to 68 and its afterlives in France. Like, Sampapye was not a movement only of the 90s. It goes back to that revolutionary trajectory out of 1968. So that was definitely an influence, even though, of course, the securitization that Nandita is talking about was definitely happening in the U.S. You also saw that 2006 mass demonstrations of A Day Without Immigrants. But it was also, I was struggling with, because this was a question in the Toronto context, is there a horizon beyond asking for regularization, that is asking for some kind of pathway for people to become permanent residents or citizenship? Yes, people were advocating for that, but is there not a horizon beyond that? And the movements in the U.S. for me were raising that problem. They were raising it in Canada. We were also talking about, because there was a wave of xenophobic attacks and murders in the South African context, so we briefly mentioned some of the responses of that from the shack dwellers movement. So these were all some of the conversations kind of happening and more that I think shaped some of the direction points of the piece politically.
I mean, one of the things that I really always quote from the piece is this idea that borders are a utopian way of thinking. They are a dream, as you said, Bridget. But what I also notice is that you, throughout the piece, really insist on calling it a practical political project, which to me is a way of linking what we do in the here and now to those future dreams of a world without borders. So maybe you can talk about what it means to you to insist on calling it a practical political project.
Well, I think in part it's that it's not a future project.
Yeah.
You know, it's a project that is in the present.
Right.
Mm. And that we have to recognize that no borders is being made, and it is being made in our movements. Because I think too often we have this vision of, oh, we're working towards this kind of future that isn't, well, maybe it's going to happen, but it's not going to happen in the next 10 years. You know, but actually it is happening, and it's happening now. And we have to recognize and celebrate that, partly in order to be able to keep going, but partly because, you know, these are real achievements. And I think that, you know, we talked a bit about kind of friendship and Comrade Plus. And for me, that is no borders. That is a no borders way of being in this world. So, yeah, so I think part of it is not limiting ourselves to thinking about the future. That's not to say that we're not accountable for the future, or we're not making futures in our presence. And yeah, so exactly. I think that's also part of what No Borders is. It's making the No Borders futures in our present.
And I think it was also called a practical political project because it was recognizing that people on the move who are crossing nationalized borders without state permission were enacting a no borders ethos, right? Just saying, I cannot live in a world with borders. I need to cross this border. I will cross this border. I have crossed this border. And we all have to learn from that, right? And deal with that and see that as the world that we would rather live in. So it was practical in the sense that people were actually carrying it out. But it was also a political project because many of those acts of defying national borders may have been understood in very kind of personal, individual terms. And, you know, knowing from our own lives that politics don't land spontaneously in your consciousness and have to actually be fostered and encouraged, and you have to know that the politics exists, that a politics of no borders needed to become a mobilizing effort. So with people who have already crossed the borders, who are already enacted in their own lives an ethos of no borders, building a movement together. And also a no borders practical political project means rejecting the citizenship migration divide, right? Rejecting the binary between citizen and migrant. So it's also a political project for everyone, right? It wasn't, you know, in that kind of classic migrant justice mode that we're helping migrants. This was, we're all in this together. We want this world together. We don't want to be citizens, and we don't want to be migrants, right? We want something else.
And I suppose in terms of thinking about the development of those arguments, I mean, developing towards demanding the abolition of citizenship rather than, oh, we can all be citizens in some place or other, I think is increasingly important as part of rejecting the migrant-citizen divide.
Yeah, one thing I really appreciate about the practical political project, and also about what you said earlier, Cynthia, about what Nandita and Bridget brought to your thinking about borders, in terms of the interconnectedness of kind of the labor struggles, anti-capitalism, really challenging the nation state form and the no borders politics, that connectivity is actually something that we talked to you about, Nandita, when we interviewed you last time. And that kind of keeps on reappearing in my head is there was a moment in which we were kind of reflecting on how we imagined the nation state to be as a kind of home as an isolated house, home rule, right? And that perhaps, especially in the rich world, to use a term for this kind of post-metropole thing that we're living in, at least we're living in, but that borders and nation states and citizenship do this work of allowing us to think that we're living in splendid isolation, whereas actually, if you look at the real world that we live in, it's completely built on deep relations of extraction, exploitation. It's deeply entangled. And that's one thing that became really clear to me as well over the last few days as we spent together at a conference, where there was a continuous emphasis on ports and on kind of this immense, immense flow of goods. Of course, we all know about it. I think about it a lot. And still, to kind of see these port images, to see these infrastructures in place, to see people talk about the ships and the traffic, to see these maps where the lines are thicker than you can imagine of the trade that goes in between all parts of the world, but of course, especially the poor world towards the rich world, right? And then you see alongside that, all of these people dying and made to die, left to die, and all these infrastructures in place that make these people make those lethal journeys, etc. I think also when you think of No Borders as a practical political project, it is people moving for their lives in the broad sense. It can be survival, but it can also be expanding your life. But moving for their lives, practically expanding their room for living in this world that's already super interconnected. It's not a nation state world at all, even though it is, apparently. And so all of this to move towards, when you write that borders are thoroughly ideological. This is what I think about when I read that sentence. Just this mindfuck almost, where you're supposed to think in a container-like way, in a world that's, you need to put on so many blinding glasses to actually think that way. And yet we all think that way. So could you reflect a little bit on calling borders an ideological project?
Well, firstly, I think it's really important that you bring up the movement of goods. And not only the movement of goods, the movement of data, the movement of finance, which we never talk about, and the movement of ideas. You know, we're in a world that is on the move, and on the move even more so at a time of ecological devastation and climate change. Everything is actually moving. So one of the work of borders is to make the movement of people seem unnatural.
Some people.
And but it could be any people. I mean, I think that's also something to remember. I mean, as we saw with Brexit, for example, you know, suddenly what seemed like the natural movement that we didn't notice of people from Europe to the UK suddenly became like massively bureaucratized and actually quite a problem. And while immigration controls, I think, are primarily designed to keep out people from the poor world or the global poor, because actually you can be poor and from a rich country, and they're also designed to stop that kind of movement. But actually, of their nature, they also can capture rich people. And then people are really shocked. It's like, really? But it's not supposed to keep out me. I'm from Canada. So I think it's sort of complicated around that. But we were talking in the conference about marinage and flight. And I've got a colleague, Julia O'Connell Davidson, who's looking at the ways in which the movement of many people, including undocumented migrants, is cast as modern slavery. But she argues that it's actually modern marinage, people fleeing oppressive relations. But as Nandita said in the conference sum up, there are no kind of mountaintops anymore. You know, there's no islands. Where are we fleeing to? So we have to make those relations in the world that we're in. However, finance has got plenty of islands, plenty of mountaintops where it's kind of free, in inverted commas. So in some ways, I think you can see both continuity and actual difference. And in some ways, it's got harder. And maybe in some ways, as we've been talking about, the growth in organizing around No Borders and the recognition of No Borders as a practical political project. I think things are much better now than they were 15 years ago, I would say, in terms of the politics around it. But it's also got tougher. Anyway, sorry, I don't even remember what you were talking about.
You're talking about borders as ideological. Mm, and I think in our article, we were referring to the fact that borders are not meant to keep people out. Mm. They do that at a certain level. And we know that increasingly borders are killing more and more people. So it's not to dismiss the power of borders, but it's also to say that states and capital cannot shut the borders down, right? Yeah. But what they can do is grant very subordinate statuses to the people who end up crossing them.
Yeah.
And that is something that is increasing. And that's what we were referring to as the ideological nature of the borders. Because I think in the popular imagination, border controls are meant to stop people from moving.
Yeah.
And we were arguing that they're not meant to stop people from moving. They're meant to stop people from having the rights that are seen as, you know, the basis of the existence of nation states. So I think, again, challenging nationalisms and challenging our national sense of self as rights-bearing citizens
in a national home.
In a national home is so critical to ending capitalism, right? Because the reason people are given subordinated statuses is to make them cheaper and politically weaker in nationalized labor markets, right? So we live in a world, but labor markets have been captured by nation states, and nationalization of the capitalist wage has also nationalized our imagination of who we are and encouraged us to be fascists, right? Encourage us to say, this is my job, not your job. Yeah. This is my place, not your place. So,
but just to add to that, so I think it's not only the nationalization of the capitalist wage, but I would say that in Europe, at least, it's the nationalization of the welfare state.
Yes, for sure.
And that, you know, well, we can't have these immigrants coming in because then they're going to take away from this national welfare state, which is imagined as some kind of piggy bank that only citizens have put in and has nothing to do with extraction from other countries. Exactly. And then the other thing that I would say is that we are in a world where labor is less and less necessary. You know, the actual pool of workers required by capital is getting smaller and smaller. But what immigration controls also do is enable profit to be extracted from the movement of people and from the control of the movement of people. So therefore, from life itself, I don't have to exploit you for your wages. I can exploit you and make money from you by keeping you in prison, by setting up machines to keep you out and selling them to states. And there's, there's lots of ways in which money can be made from people now that is not about actually extracting and exploiting their labor.
It's really grim.
Yeah, I was reading this really nice poem, which I can't remember now, but basically it had this great line of refusing to lose. And I think that's what we have to do, is just like, no, we refuse to lose. We're not going to lose. I don't care how many hundreds of years it takes. In the end, we're going to win.
Speaking of utopias, but people did tend to see no borders as either some kind of bad policy proposal they wanted to debate or as a classic example of, you know, some kind of 19th century utopian proposal that you can kind of just blow off. So in between those, we were trying to insist on its practical political character and the need to reinvent politics along the way.
But what I really like, Nandita, in how you speak about borders as not designed or even meant to block people, but rather to sort them into different kinds of people with different kinds of rights and subjugate certain people and create a class of cheap labor that is easily exploited, but will also resist, of course. It's this emphasis on how it creates all these categories of different kinds of people. And you write very beautifully, I think, in your piece about this, how it creates the idea of the good citizen, the good migrant, and then the good parent, the good mother, the good father. And I like how you also bring in parenthood, because it really touches on how insidious this is and how much it gets into our most intimate spheres, right? Like really into your most important relations become mediated by this border and by these politics. And then at the same time, it's within these immediate relationships where the resistance is, right? Mm. You're talking about this irritation and joy and friendship and comrade plus. That's also where the resistance is, right? Mm. Maybe you can speak a bit about this sort of intimacy and how it's shaped there.
Because that maybe also brings up one of our themes about where is a border? Because even though we do talk a great deal about national borders for obvious reasons, we also talk about where is the border, no? In terms of everyday practice and everyday life, in terms of how we relate to each other. And that also ties in with what you were talking a bit about, Bridget, which is how this ties into notions around welfare state entitlements and all of that. But it also does create what you're saying. You know how Marx talks about the way in which wage labor creates a subjectivity profoundly at war with itself in a certain way, right? There's a way in which you could think about that in relation to what borders do to subjectivities.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, just even in my own lived experience, you know, I was born in India in a very expansive understanding of family, you know, which included all of my cousins. Like, there wasn't even a word for cousin. I mean, they were your brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
And your aunts and your uncles and your grandparents and your great-grandparents and, you know, on and on and on. And then we moved to Canada, whose immigration policy redefined us as a nuclear family. Right? And the wife was, you know, my mother, who was sponsored by my father.
Yeah.
I mean, even these terms are so hideous and so imbued with patriarchal violence.
Yeah, it gives you shivers, really.
And creates dependency. Yeah.
And creates financial dependency and then legal dependencies. Yeah.
Which was a big part of the feminist anti-racist critique.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it did reshape my imagination, you know, along with many other things like the educational system of who my family was and the intimacies that I was forced to abandon as a result of that, right? And then the narrowing of intimacies, as feminists have long known, is the incubator for violence, right? When you have smaller and smaller people that you can count on.
Yeah.
But I suppose, in a way, you can see immigration controls as a kind of laboratory that exposes these processes, because actually, precisely, it's not only immigration controls that do this. It is also a welfare state.
Absolutely.
So there's a whole series of state processes that get naturalized, but then exposed when you see how they're working in immigration controls. And I think actually a lot of the work that needs to be done in dismantling the border between the migrant and the citizen is precisely to show it's not just connections, it's actually commonalities. And to say, yeah, we are in this together, and we need to see migrant and citizen struggles as completely imbricated, rather than, like, you know, there's the migrant who's crossing the border, there's the irregular migrant, then there's the hardworking family man, and then there's the unemployed person. I think we need to find ways of bringing these together and learning also from each other's movements. So one of the things that I'm particularly interested in at the moment is looking at the disabled people's movement and their notion that it's society disables people with impairments. And actually, there's a lot, I think, that can be learned from that by migration struggles. You know, that peoples aren't migrants, they're migrantized, they're made into migrants by state processes. And then what are the political consequences of that in terms of both analysis and organizing? So I think there's lessons that can be learned, as well as strength to be had from actually rejoining these movements. Because I think also, you know, one of the things we can learn from Marcus Rediker's fantastic work is that actually these struggles weren't separate. They were made separate. They were divided.
Through violence.
So now, you know, it's about rediscovering those connections and repairing the divides that have been made.
Yeah, which I think when I look back at that editorial, the historical parts are very fragmentary because of that. You know, we were touching on particular moments where you could re-knit the proletarian body, as, you know, Marcus Rediker and Peter Linebaugh talk about. But it wasn't fully fleshed out. And I think now that's part of the project we're working on now, to think about those questions historically from a bottom-up approach. But that's, I think, one place we would want to take that article more deeply, right, is to explore some of those connections historically, but also their implications for contemporary movements, huh?
Yeah, let's actually talk a little bit about that. Like in the piece, you draw a kind of genealogy or a history of the No Border movement, and you go back to the moment of 1968. And we were wondering about this genealogy, like why you positioned your piece in relation to those conversations, and maybe also what other histories could have been drawn, or kind of reflect a little bit on that way of historically positioning.
Well, I think that we've all learned a lot since we wrote that piece.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we've learned, which I think is really important for ensuring a No Borders movement, is that all states control people's mobility.
Mm.
You know, the focus of quote-unquote migration studies, which we all in one way or another came out of, focused on nation states for the obvious reasons that they're interested in immigration controls, but recognizing that there's multiple ways that states have controlled people's mobilities and at the same time relied on those very people to ensure profits and wealth for those who controlled the state is really important in terms of making it very clear, if it wasn't already clear to us, more clear that the problem is the existence of states, right? Mm. And the problem really is the existence of ruling classes who then construct a state to protect themselves, right? That is the project. We already knew that, obviously, in our Why No Borders article. We, you know, very clearly said a No Borders politics is revolutionary, right? It is an anti-capitalist, anti-statist project. So we knew that already, but I think that has even been deepened for us, at least for me, not to speak for the two of you, but it's really been deepened to me that until we are free of capital in the States, we're just going to have to keep reinventing the struggle.
Yeah, so one of the things that I've learned is that where you start, how you frame historically where you start from actually is politically really important.
Mm.
So I think in the same way that we have to think kind of in a spatially different way, I think we also need to think in a temporally different way. So I love the work that Nandita and her partner Gay do around contemporary diggers, because I think that does precisely that. Who do you claim as your political ancestors?
Mm-hmm.
And I've been thinking about this a lot as well in terms of, you know, well, how do you claim history? Because I think that's a really good example of the ways in which our imaginations have been so thoroughly nationalized because actually the ways in which your claim to a history is validated is actually through ancestry, through nation, through blood, which we want to reject.
Yeah.
And so I think thinking about our political ancestors, our political kinfolk, whatever, our political comrades plus, I think is also a really important political project.
And what would be some of those ancestors to you, or kinship, or comrades plus?
Well, so I do think the diggers, I think...
We need some explanation, I think, of the diggers. I have never heard of this particular kind of people.
The diggers were in the 17th century in a place now known as England, and their common lands were being enclosed by the newly formed British Parliament. And what they did was literally dig up the hedges and fences that had been used to enclose the commons and to dig in food that they literally needed to continue to live, right? Mm. So there's kind of multiple meanings of their digging.
Mm.
But they call themselves diggers because one of the identities that was emerging in competition at that time was the free-born Englishman, right? So to call themselves diggers and to very explicitly be opposed to slavery, be opposed to the British Empire that was forming at that time was revolutionary, right? So for my partner and I, who were both born in former British colonies, to say that our people are the diggers from this place now known as England, I think shows that both the diggers and us are rejecting the nations that claim us.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. I love also that it's referring to a practice rather than sort of an identity or whatever. Exactly. It's also our podcast, not to plug it too often, but it's called the Verbranders, which is Dutch for those who burn, right? Mm. And who are engaged in the burning of borders metaphorically or maybe also in other ways. So, yeah, I really like that a lot. I'm looking forward to learn more about it at some point.
Call your podcast The Burners and The Diggers.
Diggers and burners, I like it.
Yeah, but this whole question of what political and historical ancestors you claim is a really interesting one, can be a very fraught one as well. I mean, we do have kind of some interesting moments of histories we gestured to in that piece that we would probably set up differently now or expand on, partly because there's a lot more interesting historical work being done in this area that we could now work with, right? But I think just to go back to why the reference to 1968 that I made, just for one moment, that was partly because we referenced the Sans-Papiers movement, which a lot of people thought came up only in the 90s.
Yeah.
But all the work that's been done on it shows its roots in the kind of revolutionary cycle from about 68 to 73 and all that emerged from that and the trajectory out of it, which is actually long and complicated. But for me, it raises this question that in every kind of global revolutionary wave, and 68 was that, the question of mobility, citizenship, movement, all these questions get posed anew, right? So there was a brief reference in there, mainly because I wanted to make sure that, you know, we were signaling the Sans-Papiers thing was not something that jumped up somewhere in the middle of the 1990s. It had an interesting story there in terms of the way in which a lot of, you know, not to center them, but a lot of French intellectuals who were in the Pantheon now, we're all part of doing that work, from Michel Foucault and Alain Badiou and Etienne Balibar and all these sort of people. But the other kind of pieces I think we pull out are quick references to the industrial workers of the world. I think we misname them as international workers of the world, but that whole anarcho-syndicalist tradition, right? Yeah. Which was in good part destroyed by the deportation of them in 1919. That's another kind of key moment. But I think there's also that citation we have in there from William Walters, where he said something to the effect that, you know, all class struggle has to be rethought from the standpoint of movement, or put it this way, that lines of flight and mobility is a fundamental part of the tools people use in class struggle or lines of escape, right? So obviously people have built a great deal much more on that question. But for me, what I would want to add to it now is, because Nandita was talking about all states control movement, and we think about that in terms of national states. What interests me now is, how do we get from local control of mobility to national states, particularly in states like the U.S., where you precisely had a situation where the national state didn't want to have national control of mobility because that was in the hands of the states, local states, controlled mobility to protect the slave trade. Huh? Mm-hmm. So the whole question about how local states in the United States and how that became a matter of control of mobility at the national level is a really fraught story that can't really be told without engaging with the history of slavery and its abolition and the Civil War, right? That's a long piece of it, right? And some of the early controls of mobility of enslaved people, but also free Black people. How did that work in that context? And then how does it become, after the Civil War, a matter of national control? So there's a whole variety of different questions, as well as the history of early capitalism, that we would probably want to engage with now.
and something I also thought of while reading the piece is, so I don't have an intimate knowledge or practice with the Sans-Papiers movement, but more so, I guess, with more recent movements. And what I suspect is that the people who were illegalized, who were rising up, they themselves brought a tremendous amount of practice with them, of struggle, from all the places that they moved from. I mean, there's a lot of research, and also something that I have encountered myself in the last few years, that people bring slogans that were sung in Syria to the borders of Europe. And I think that's a question I left with when reading not just the piece, but I guess reflecting on the whole body of work that the piece also intervenes in, that there's something there to really think more about.
Including thinking 68 as a global revolutionary wave, because I'm not trying to set up here this sense of it as something that's about mini skirts on the steps of the Sorbonne type of scenario about what 68 was, but understanding it as a global revolutionary wave and how that shaped the trajectory of people on the move in that period.
Yeah, and so we could actually link up like the Occupy movement with the quote-unquote Arab Spring, right?
Yeah.
Like, there's all kinds of ways of narrating history that either open up a kind of international perspective or shut that down and turn it into a national one.
Yeah, exactly. Which is what's happened a bit with 68, yeah.
And I think it will be a good moment to listen to our second song.
Why not?
Yeah.
Why not? Yeah, right?
Some music. Let's listen.
And maybe Bridget wants to introduce it.
Yeah, so I really like the Sakala song, but the reason I suggested it was because I think it captures this connection that we've really talked about, which is about how migrant struggles and the struggles of marginalized citizens, both citizens of color, but also white citizens, are really the same. And if you think they're separate, then you're falling for the divide. And I think that he captures that really nicely. Hmm.
Absolute power corrupts absolutely, but absolute powerlessness does the same. It's not the poverty, it's the inequality we live with every day that will turn us insane. Absolute power corrupts absolutely, but absolute powerlessness does the same. It's not the poverty, it's the inequality we live with every day that will turn us insane. In a scheme of living, my life wasn't hard, but as far as Britain goes, shit, I practically starved. Sleeping in a tracksuit, gas meter running out, electric cut off as well, candles lighting up the house. Looking in my mother's eyes, I see how she feels. The strain and the pain of just paying bills that ain't real. And that's how I grew, like so many more. And now it's part of who I am very sure. You wanna know the rage I feel in my stomach? No, my mom and dad split up when I was still in her stomach. And not everything that happened I will put in 16s, but I will tell you enough so you will know what I mean. My boy's mother got cancer the same time as mine, but his mother died and mine survived. Shit was fucked back then, when I was like 10, already had the mental strength more than many grown men. Absolute power corrupts absolutely, but absolute powerlessness does the same. It's not the poverty, it's the inequality we live with every day that will turn us insane. Absolute power corrupts absolutely, but absolute powerlessness does the same. It's not the poverty, it's the inequality we live with every day that will turn us insane. This was a couple years after my stepdad left. Did he really know the crazy mess that he left? Cause mom's done recover from the lumps in her neck, but being poor and alone couldn't cope with the stress. Her and my big sis fought so much so that now I hadn't left school. When she left home, I was 13 by now, still a little kid, innocent. Next couple years though, we'll turn him to a militant. That is the result of no food in the fridge. And every other day you're getting searched by the pigs. Plus these patronizing teachers, though my grade sick, trying to emasculate me, yeah, turn me to a bitch. And I don't mean a woman, please let me be clear. I mean a spineless man, because what do they fear? More than a working class black male with a brain. When our energy is harnessed, everything changed. Look at Pac, look at Marley, look at Hendrix, look at Garvey. This is the potential that is wasted on a daily basis. A racist, classist world that we live in. Still we coming for nothing and we educate millions. Absolute power corrupts absolutely, but absolute powerlessness does the same. It's not the poverty, it's the inequality we live with every day that will turn us insane. Absolute power corrupts absolutely, but absolute powerlessness does the same. It's not the poverty, it's the inequality we live with every day that will turn us insane.
Yeah, I really like this emphasis on inequality as the key problem, but also that powerlessness also corrupts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I think there can be this tendency, and I think particularly in kind of academic work, to see, you know, the migrant as some kind of like innocent person, a suffering person, you know, someone that is just almost superhuman on account of their suffering and pain. And I think that he captures, you know, why we have to recognize that power and powerlessness and inequality is something that undermines us as people, you know, all of us. It's cool.
I like it a lot as well for those reasons. And what I always really, really am impressed by is just the clarity of, you know, being able to put all these things into these few sentences in a song. And we need a whole book to convey these kinds of messages. And then we end with an epilogue to talk about emotion a bit, which she also manages to get in, right? So I find it really impressive also.
But just to talk back to your comment a little bit.
Yeah.
I think we're both part of the movement.
Yeah.
The musicians and the academics and the activists, right?
No,
it's one movement that we're all part of, and we're hearing each other in different ways, and it's all building together, right? Like, we hear this music and it makes us write something.
Yeah.
And perhaps Akala has read a lot of stuff that allows him to write that.
Yeah,
right?
Quite likely.
Yeah.
So we're all musicians. We're all academics.
Yeah.
We're all, you know. So in a way, that's one of the challenges with the term scholar activist, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like, why is that just not assumed, you know?
Yeah.
Assume that there's a purpose to all this learning. Mm. And that might be, for us at least, building the world we would like to live in and contributing to that.
I
absolutely agree, and let me qualify my own intervention by saying that I think there is something to be added, right, to a song, and there's a value in doing that in a book form.
But there is also something about music and solidarity and the ways in which participating in music is an embodiment of solidarity and connection and togetherness that I think is a really important, I don't want to use a military metaphor, but I can't think of another one at the moment. It's an important weapon in our armory. So music, I think, is something that we can really draw kind of energy and strength from.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I want to say something about music now, but when talking about music, I usually regret it because there's something that happens that's actually really hard to catch into words, but our listeners might not know that I'm also a musician, and I absolutely love music. It's my other life. Just recently my partner organized a music night in one of the kind of social centers that we're part of, and it was just such a magical moment. So there were a lot of people who play rebetiko, which is like music that developed in Greece but right after like the huge population swaps between Greece and Turkey. So it's like this underground music that developed in the prisons and and it's being kept alive by generation after generation after generation of people. It's of course also captured and capitalized upon, and there's versions of it that make your soul die. But there's also the alive version that's just passed on and on and on. And me and my partner fell in love with that music and played it a lot. And we have a life with that music. And then there was also a Brazilian band that was playing music that was developed through the struggles of settler colonialism there and through plantation slavery, which was huge. And they were playing that music. And then there was the Greek music. And then after each playing their music, we all sat together and played it together. And there was such an intensity of listening to each other. And we started then playing different kinds of music that combined elements of and teaching each other songs. And it is hard to talk about without sounding like, oh, yay, we just fixed the world, which we clearly didn't. We didn't abolish all of these regimes that continue to divide us. And there is power even in that space. But there is also the kind of transcendence of yourself in that moment that is just so joyful and beautiful. And
So that's part of what we were talking about before, isn't it? Which is that actually we make these moments also in the present.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's not just a future dream.
Well, with those beautiful words, can we say thank you? Thank you, thank you, thank you for coming. And thank you for sharing this with us.
Well, thank you so much for allowing us to have this conversation with one another and with you.
Yeah,
really appreciate it.
Yeah, and thanks also for the ongoing work of the podcast, the way in which you are creating this beautiful infrastructure for these kind of critical dialogues in our movement, for rethinking the meaning of ideas and knowledge in our movements and collectivizing what we know. And to me, it's a really important part of the ongoing No Border struggle.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we end this episode, Bridget, Cynthia, and Andita wanted to do a shout out to Sherry Aiken.
Yeah, so we really could not have done this piece that was the focus of our conversation without the support and hard work of Sherry Aiken, who at that time was the editor of the journal Refuge that the special issue is a part of. And she herself has a politics of no borders, and that was crucial for her giving us an academic space to allow this conversation to happen.
We also want to thank a few people and collectives. B. Carrot for the illustrations we sometimes use on our social media. Thomas from Dark Roast for the graphic design. Joris and David and Alan Aneska for the theme music. And the Medusa Magic Studio for allowing us to use their space to record our podcast.